walk out of our apartments, our like houses, our dorms, and all we think about is the fact that ICE could be here.
UNC Chancellor Lee Roberts faces backlash after he says the university will comply with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Welcome to Carolina Connection. I'm Chumasi Duamensa.
And I'm W.H. Hayes. Also this week, local Congresswoman Valerie Fouché details how Democrats are opposing President Donald Trump's aggressive effort to remake the federal government. A Carrboro music shop balances its role in the community with keeping the doors open. And students and community leaders explore how to celebrate Black history beyond February.
Black History Month to me is a reminder that, hey, these are your roots too.
From the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media, this is Carolina Connection. Thank you for joining us. The Department of Homeland Security is now allowing ICE to enforce immigration laws in sensitive locations like universities. Some schools are refusing to cooperate with ICE, but UNC Chancellor Lee Roberts said he'll comply. That has left some students fearful for their safety. Gauri Abhinanda has more on the community backlash against Roberts' decision.
We're going to follow the law.
That's Chancellor Lee Roberts during a faculty council meeting January 24th.
And that's been our consistent posture.
And the posture he's speaking of is complying with the new directive which now allows U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, otherwise known as ICE, to detain undocumented students on campus. This comes after President Donald Trump signed an executive order ending sensitive locations, which previously protected places like universities, hospitals, and churches from ICE enforcement. Michelle Delgado, staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina, condemns Roberts' compliance with ICE. She says it violates the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, protecting student information. It also disregards the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause and the Civil Rights Act for race, color, or national origin-based discrimination.
UNC allows undocumented students to apply to their university to pay tuition, but now when it comes to supporting and protecting students, they may take the choice of not protecting those undocumented students. So it's okay to take their tuition money, but it's not okay to protect their privacy. It just doesn't quite make sense, and it's a bit unfair.
In a letter to the ACLU, Roberts said the university has a duty to comply with the law and that it will uphold FERPA. He added that directory information is available to third parties upon request and doesn't include a student's immigration status. However, birth location is included, and the ACLU maintains UNC doesn't have to disclose student information. Roberts expressed at the council meeting that UNC is committed to all of its students.
I'm well aware of the anxiety, and we're going to continue to try to serve our immigrant students and scholars as best we can.
But students like Senior Laura Saavedra Forero, an organizer with the Southern Student Action Coalition, is skeptical about this statement of support.
My name is Laura, and I am the proud daughter of padres inmigrantes colombianos.
Saavedra Forero was one of the many organizers who helped organize the protest against UNC's decision at South Building on Wednesday.
They left to claim this idea of Carolina for all. And forget to put the asterisk because clearly that's not the case.
Andrea Lopez, sophomore and outreach director of UNC's Linking Immigrants to New Communities, which provides English and other resources to immigrants, says there is fear within the community, even for legal citizens because of how they look.
We walk out of our apartments, our like houses, our dorms, and all we think about is the fact that ICE could be here.
In response to the directive, Lopez said students are distributing Know Your Rights cards and organizing direct actions.
No matter what happens, I assure all of you that my feet are firmly planted to this country, and no matter how strong.
Knowing that there's so many people who believe what you believe is empowering itself.
Saavedra Forero echoes this gratitude for community support and mobilization.
These are the people who have helped me get through my time at Carolina, the ones who continue to show up, the ones who understand that this fight is long and hard and interconnected, and just a lot of love.
As students continue to fight, they hope UNC will follow schools like Berkeley and the University of California, which have refused to cooperate with ICE. In Chapel Hill, I'm Gauri Abhinanda.
Elon Musk, head of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, has seized information from the U.S. Treasury, including financial and personal identifying information, to stop payments from the United States Agency for International Development. Musk has said it's a part of a larger effort to cut what he sees as waste and fraud and even criminal activity out of government. Publicly, the Treasury has said that Musk and Doge just have read-only access, but Democratic lawmakers are still alarmed. North Carolina 4th District Congresswoman Valerie Fushi joins us now to talk about Democrats' response to Doge's unprecedented actions. Congresswoman Fushi, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
What has being in Congress been like since January?
It's been interesting, a little bumpy, but it has been interesting. And we're just reminded that we have work to do, that the American people have sent us here to do their bidding.
Many left-leaning voters have been wondering where the Democrats are. What are you and other Democrats currently doing?
Well, I think it's interesting to be asked that question a lot, because Democrats are doing everything we can, first of all, to protect the American public's money, the American public's freedom, and the American public's liberties. And what it doesn't seem to be getting across is that we don't control Congress. We don't control the White House. And so we are doing what we can to do those things that I just said. One of the things that we have done is to visit these agencies that the president has proposed to close. Just this morning, I was at the Department of Education with a number of Democratic members of Congress demanding a meeting with the secretary, and we were denied access to the public building at the public access door. We did the same thing at the Department of Treasury. There were members of the Democratic caucus who also went to the Department of Health. So we're doing what we can to not only get these meetings and try to understand what it is that is being proposed for the American people against what has been promised.
Another question I had is, what should North Carolinians be worried about in regards to Elon Musk possibly having their information?
They should be worried about what Elon Musk plans to do with having their information. What does it benefit a person who has not been elected? What does he plan to do with this information? And how is it helping any of us? North Carolinians and Americans in general should be worried about a person who has not been elected to serve, to have access to personal data, particularly as it relates to Medicare and Medicaid and veterans benefits. What's the goal?
What is something that the Democrats are capable of doing in response to this sort of thing? What can they do about Elon Musk and whatever he's doing?
Well, I think what you'll see is, and what is being done, is that we are using the court system to determine what is legal and what is constitutional. And so that's something that has to play out through that system. But in the meantime, we are moving to introduce legislation that will define what can and cannot be done and to block what shouldn't be done.
What would that look like if it got to the Supreme Court? Is it possible that something else outside of the rule of law might happen in that circumstance?
It is absolutely possible. But again, you know, President Trump was elected by the American public. And to watch what is happening real time, that during the election season, he distanced himself from it. And within the span of 2 weeks, we are seeing what the attempts are to implement Project 2025.
Congresswoman Fushi, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's been a pleasure. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Federal agencies like the Defense Department will no longer celebrate identity months like Black History Month. But Black educators and community figures are pushing to keep Black history alive year-round. Maya Hagen highlights those efforts.
Inside the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Vice President of the Black Student Movement, Hannah Adams, stops in front of a massive new mural of stone. Vibrant colors stretch across the wall, an abstract depiction of Black resilience and heritage.
Black History Month to me is a reminder that, hey, these are your roots too.
But for Adams and others, the question remains, how do we make the most out of the shortest month of the year? UNC journalism professor Carl Kenny, who often reports on race relations, says this can be done in a few ways.
For me, I think it's critical that we think about both the importance of telling the stories of the Black historical stories, but also we have to think about why it's important that we continue to tell those stories.
But this year, the push for continued storytelling takes on new weight as several federal agencies have announced that following new executive orders, they will be suspending formal Black History Month events. As a result, educators and community leaders like Kenny are working hard to ensure that Black history remains a vital year-round event.
What we do is we tell the story. I think we find people who remember the days long ago, we find people who were present, who fought the fight, and who encountered hardships. We tell the story of Black men, Black women, and how they had to fight through systems that were against them.
Daniel Bullock, co-founder of Durham-based nonprofit We Are, an acronym for Working to Extend Anti-Racist Education, says the organization not only makes the most out of the month, but also they do this beyond February.
So we do anti-racism summer camps for children and rising first through fifth grade. And we've been hosting these camps since 2016. It's an intentionally diverse space to discuss issues of race and to help kids develop language to understand race, racism, and how to dismantle structural racism.
For Bullock, celebrating Black History Month goes beyond just recognition.
At the local grassroots state level, we need to increase our advocacy. We need to increase our connections with our community. We need to keep people informed. We need to show people why it's important to learn this history and expand the opportunities that people have to learn Black history and other people's history.
With this call to action in mind, Adams says that meaningful change often begins in the most accessible places, our local institutions.
It starts with speaking up in your classes. It starts with speaking up in your clubs. It starts with making a change on campus, even if it's just little things. And I think that's what's really special.
As Black History Month begins, community leaders are working to ensure that conversations about Black history continue beyond February. Through storytelling, education, and community engagement, they aim to keep Black history present year-round. In Chapel Hill, I'm Maya Hagen.
The Trump administration has issued a slew of executive orders targeting trans Americans. Trump's orders have barred trans people from serving in the military, banned trans women from competing in female categories of sports, and outlawed gender-affirming care for anyone under the age of 19. Joining me now is Maddie Policastro to break these changes down and how they could affect the trans community. Thanks for chatting with me, Maddie.
Thanks for having me.
So these are a lot of executive orders for a segment of the population that just represents about 1.6% of Americans. Why is the trans community such a target for the Trump administration?
Yeah, it's really about making a statement for Trump's administration. There's a really big emphasis on protecting children, yet the children are such a small segment of the population of trans people to begin with. I spoke with Dean Nielsen, who is a trans woman who transitioned after she turned 19. And even though she transitioned later in life, she said a lot of these feelings about transitioning later were because of the repression and negative stereotypes that were surrounding being trans at the time when she was growing up. And she's really concerned that a lot of this legislation and just the wording of it specifically are contributing to more of this repression and are going to cause the same impacts for future generations. Here is a clip from her right now mentioning this.
For me, I repressed that, you know, well throughout high school. But if I had stopped repressing those feelings at 15 or 17, I could have so easily realized that this was who I was meant to be. And to not receive that appropriate medical care for 2-3 years until I was a legal adult, I think would have been quite devastating for me.
Of course, there are quite a lot of restrictions and rhetoric that trans people are having to navigate. In your talk with Nielsen, something that came up is what trans people need in this charged moment. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, Nielsen said that the thing that's really important for trans people, both herself and also other younger trans people who are going to be more directly impacted by these legislations, was this continued and stable allyship. That's going to be very important, but people just aren't receiving it right now. There's really, even from the Democrats, there's really a lack of attention to this issue. And the media, there are so many things going on with so many other executive orders that are targeting people like immigrants and that sort of thing. So there's just not this focus. It's become so normalized in society that trans people are going to be targeted and it's just going to happen. She mentioned the bathroom bill that happened in North Carolina quite a few years ago, where businesses and concerts were pulling out of North Carolina to make a statement because they were just so against this bill. But bills like this are happening constantly now, and nobody's really doing anything about it just because it's so normalized. So this rhetoric is really creating just a sense of normality around, you know, harmful stereotypes about trans people, and that trans people can just be targeted and there's no repercussions.
The Trans Legislation Tracker, which tracks anti-trans bills across state legislatures across the country, noted that there were 672 anti-trans bills introduced in state legislatures in 2024. So, I mean, it's a great point. Thank you so much for joining me today, Maddie.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Carolina Connection. I'm WHAs.
And I'm Chumasi Duamensa.
TikTok's fate in the U.S. still hangs in the balance after the Trump administration gave an extension to the app's Chinese owner to find somebody in the U.S. to buy it. If that doesn't happen, there's a chance the app could shut down as it did briefly last month. UNC professor Rosa Lee is a former researcher at the Winston National Center on Technology Use and Brain and Psychological Development. She joined Carolina Connection's Sarah Ellis to discuss potential impacts a TikTok ban could have on young adults.
Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks so much for having me.
With the potential ban of TikTok, what can we expect to see, if anything? What kind of changes do you think will happen?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting research question. And if TikTok does get banned, I think for like the average casual TikTok user, I personally would guess that we wouldn't see too much like psychological impact from losing TikTok. And that's because TikTok is just one of many apps that serves up, you know, short form videos that play automatically based on some algorithm that is designed to get you on the platform for as long as possible. So my guess would be that if TikTok goes away, kids are going to move, people, not just kids, but users will probably move to other short form platforms like YouTube Shorts or the like Facebook and Instagram Reels that Meta is trying to promote as well.
What do you think it would take for social media usage to decrease?
I think that's a really complex question, and there's probably no one solution to it. For folks who want to reduce their social media use, I think there's a number of potential different strategies. An easy one, well, I think theoretically easy, maybe harder to actually implement, is to keep your phones out of your bedrooms before bed. So try to get off your screens in an hour or two before bed, do something else to wind down and relax. Ideally charge your phone far away from where you sleep, so you're not tempted to like take a peek at your phone if you happen to wake up in the middle of the night. All of these things we know can help cut down on screen time and can help promote better sleep. I think there's some potential other strategies more for like middle and high schoolers now. They're increasing efforts to ban or limit the use of phones in schools. So that's probably going to cut back on time. And then this is a big picture reminder I always like to say when we're talking about social media use specifically. which is that all the platforms that you're using, they have large, well-paid teams of very smart people that are working on app design or algorithms, trying to keep you on those platforms for as long as possible. So you have a lot working against you. If you're trying to cut back on your tech use, it might be challenging. That's because people are trying to engineer things to make it hard for you. So I don't want folks to like ever feel guilty about their phone use or screen time. But I think it's also important, check in with yourself, make sure that you're using it in a way that makes you feel better, not worse. And if you are feeling like your tech use is becoming problematic, maybe talk to some friends and family about a plan to help you have a healthier relationship with technology.
Dr. Lee, thank you so much for being here today.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Located in downtown Carrboro is Twin House Music, a music retail and repair store. Besides offering a wide range of music gear, they also strive to support the local community. Andy Zhao talks to the owner and employees behind the music shop.
What you're hearing right now might not sound like an electric guitar, but it is. Robert Chamberlain, an employee at Twin House Music, is demonstrating a new effect pedal that had just come in. It turns an electric guitar into a synthesizer. Twin House Music is a music retail store and repair shop located on West Main Street in Carrboro.
I'm Brian McGee. I am the owner, manager, repair tech, buyer, organizer of things person here at Twin House.
McGee founded Twin House Music in 2018. He sought to create a store that not only offers a wide range of music gear, but also supports the vibrant music community in the Triangle area.
We're a member of the community, and we all have a responsibility to, you know, act in a positive way to just make the community thrive.
The first thing you see walking into Twin House isn't its wall of guitars, but rather a rack of t-shirts for fundraisers, including their latest offering, one that says Smash Transphobia, done by local artist and musician Billy Morehouse.
She killed it with the design, and that's a fundraiser for Equality NC.
McGee traces his aspirations for Twin House to be more than just a store back to his musical roots in 90s punk rock.
We never shied away from like doing benefit shows and like helping raise money for stuff and giving back to things. So just to be a thoughtful human, I think constantly giving back is a good path to stay on.
Although Twin House has expanded its offering and became a retailer of major brands, it hasn't always been easy. As a first-time business owner, McGee had to learn how to attract customers to buy music gear locally instead of online.
It was lean, and I didn't make very much money. Not that I'm like raking it in now, but like it was slim there for a while, and then COVID hit, and it stayed slim.
COVID was a difficult time for Twin House economically, and when the store started enforcing a strict mask policy to protect customers, complications arose. Employee Spencer Lee remembers when two customers harassed the store for making them wear masks.
I had to, use some strong tones in order to have them leave, but thankfully, we haven't had anything really like that happen since.
The tariffs are going to change everything.
I'm sure.
So he's got
a month.
In recent days, Twin House faces another challenge, the potential impact of recently announced tariffs. Store manager Stephen Mooneyhan feels slightly uneasy.
I actually had somebody come in yesterday with a guitar, and they're like, I'm glad this is made in Indonesia and not China or Mexico. And I was just like, those guitars are really good. This is, you don't need to be negatively biased because of the political thing.
McGee is concerned about the potential impact the tariffs might have on newer players who want affordable instruments. Brands have already notified him to place orders for Mexican and Chinese-made instruments as soon as possible.
This is going to play into the future of music makers if they can't afford an instrument. So, we'll see what happens. I have no idea.
Despite having to deal with recent economic changes, Twin House is optimistic about its future, hoping to continue to support the local community while offering more and more music gear.
That's awesome.
In Carrboro, I'm Eddie Zhao.
This week on the Carolina Connection podcast, we're talking about the campus housing lottery at UNC. A shortage of campus housing has forced many transfer students and underclassmen to live off campus. Despite the shortage, Chancellor Lee Roberts is adding 500 students to the incoming class with an ultimate goal of increasing the student body by 5,000 students over the next decade. Carolina Connection spoke with students about their experiences.
So I'm currently homeless because I did not win the, like, quote unquote, win the lottery for on-campus housing. We were put in, like, the next day, and they closed down, like, halfway through the day before we were supposed to get any, like, sort of slots.
It's not easy. There are constraints across the enterprise, but so far we haven't identified an insurmountable constraint.
If he wants us to have so many more students, he needs to find a way to make more housing. I mean, you're putting so many more people into like a stressful situation if you're trying to get so many more students, but you don't have anywhere to house them.
You can hear more on this week's Carolina Connection podcast, available on Spotify and on the web at carolinaconnection.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Super Bowl weekend as the Philadelphia Eagles seek revenge against the Kansas City Chiefs this Sunday. Carolina Connection's Melody Carty and Lily Kane ask students what their plans are for the big game.
I'm Gavin Wiltshire and I'm a junior.
And what are your plans for the Super Bowl this weekend?
I'll be in New York this weekend visiting my Nana for her 92nd birthday. And yeah, just probably just hanging out with my Nana and watching football. She watches it too, that's all, she just watches TV.
Hello, my name is Lily Copplestone and I'm a freshman here at UNC.
What are your plans for the Super Bowl?
I have my first clinical for my EMT class from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., so I will not be watching the Super Bowl. Thank you!
My name is Aiden Friedland and I am a senior. Probably just gonna get together with a bunch of friends and watch the game. Hopefully somebody makes like a nice like buffalo chicken dip. Yeah, I think that's the one thing that I look forward to.
My name's Tansy Brown. I'm a sophomore.
And who are you rooting for?
I honestly hate both teams, but not the Chiefs. So I guess go Birds.
All right, I am joined by fellow anchor Chumasi Duamensa and our technical director, Kevin Paris. Let's talk about the Super Bowl halftime show, gentlemen. What are we feeling for? Are we excited?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I can't wait to see how Kendrick Lamar just weaves in, you know, in that part of TV off when he says, walking in New Orleans with the etiquette of LA yelling mustard. I want to see how he weaves that into, is it going to be at the start of the show? I'm really excited.
That's right, because I actually didn't catch that lyric on any of my listens. I did not clock that it was talking about performing at the Super Bowl. I will say, the entire album in general was just brilliant.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was tailor-made for the Super Bowl. I mean,
definitely one of my favorite albums of last year.
Either way, thanks for listening to this week's edition of Carolina Connection, a production of the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media. Our technical director this week is Kevin Paris. I'm W.H. Hayes.
And I'm Chumasi Duamensa. If you like what you heard, there's plenty more from reporters past and present on our website at carolinaconnection.org and on Instagram, Facebook, and now on Blue Sky. Now back to weekend programming on 97.9 The Hill.